Hi, this is John Udell. This week I spoke with Andrew Catton and Avi Bryant of DabbleDB, a through-the-web database that we also explored in a screencast a while ago. In this conversation, we drill down into some of the underpinnings of Dabble, including the fact that it's written in Smalltalk, which really shouldn't matter to anyone, but it's still interesting to see how the Smalltalk style of direct manipulation, continuous improvement, and always live data bubbles up and is reflected in the system that people actually see and interact with. So we've got Avi Bryant and Andrew Catton.
Hello.
With DabbleDB. Hi, guys.
Hi.
For people who haven't seen the thing, let me just briefly summarize what I would describe it as, and you guys can jump in and correct or amend. So I would describe DabbleDB as a through-the-web database with elements of the kind of capability that people, I think, also expect from spreadsheets. So a very simple way to create a set of records, produce alternate views of those records, provide update and delete capabilities through the web for both the creator of the database. And here's where the twist comes in, is that because the thing lives in the cloud, it's something that's easily shared. And so really, collaboration is kind of the linchpin of the whole idea, right? That the data all lives in the cloud, and you can selectively make views available to other people, either so that trusted collaborators can edit or that others can simply view. Is that a decent summary?
Yeah, I think that's a great summary. Mm-hmm. I think where we came from was seeing a lot of people that were using spreadsheets basically as a database. Spreadsheets is a way of tracking the information that was important to their business, and that's great when it's one person using it, but you run into real problems when it's a lot of people using it, both because you end up having to email copies of spreadsheets around or worry about what the latest version is, but also because different people have very different needs when they're looking at the data. Do they want to see it broken down this way? Do they want to see it just filtered down to this subset? And what the over-the-web lets us do is to have you build a view for a very specific purpose, for a very specific role, and have lots of people working with the same data, but different aspects of it coming at it from different angles.
Yeah. There's an aspect of it as well, which is, or I think should be, an eye-opener to a lot of people, which is about the assimilation of other data that may happen to live on the web. So I can refer people in the introduction to this to the screencast that we made, but it was actually, I thought, a stunning example. The place where you reached out to simply an HTML table on the web, used your bookmarklet to import that data into your structured presentation, and you'll want to describe this a little bit more, but then it wasn't simply a flat table that you imported, but you proceeded to link it in a pseudo-relational way to the data that was existing there. So maybe you can kind of talk through how that works.
One of the things that we're really trying to do is to allow you to take your data that might have started out just as a flat spreadsheet table and make it richer. And richer can mean a lot of things. Richer might mean that if you've got date and time data in there, you want to see it as a calendar, and that's adding depth to your data. It might mean that you're integrating with services out there on the web. So if you've got currency information, amounts of money that if it's on the web, it can go and pull out a current currency exchange rate and show you that in different currencies. And it might mean that you're linking it up to other data that's out there on the web. So I think the example we did on the screencast was you have a bunch of information about states, and then you pull in from somewhere else a table of populations by state. And then suddenly state goes from being just a flat text field with the name of the state to being a real first-class thing there that knows other things about the state, like what its population is or what the state capital is, if that was useful to you.
Right.
And you can make that link from your data to this other associated data.
So how that linking is accomplished is an interesting question. We should be clear that this is not a conventional database. It's not a SQL engine under the covers. And in particular, all of this improvement, if you will, or enrichment that's happening is happening in a mode of direct manipulation. And which is kind of key, and we'll kind of come back to where the roots of that are. But mm-hmm. So just to kind of paint the picture here for people who haven't seen the screencast and are simply listening, I'm on the web. I have a table of information about, I think it was investments in companies.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now I suck in this HTML table from the web, which includes populations. What is, can you describe the process whereby I link those things up? In as much as it's not scripting, it's not querying, it's not writing SQL, it's direct manipulation. What does that feel like to the person who's doing it?
You start off in DABLE generally with text, and so you have these sort of disparate text islands, and all you need to do then is sort of go in and say, well, just give Dabble a bit more information and say that this piece of text represents this. And Dabble's going to go off and look for linkages. So you would say that, for example, you know, the state name is an important thing, and that's appearing in two places, and it's possible to link them up and sort of unify them in the system. And it's just going to go and look for matches and sort of do the right thing as much as possible.
Okay.
So it's meant to be sort of a click and point kind of process, right?
So the idea is if I can arrange for two different tables to have names in common, then Dabble is going to notice that commonality and offer to connect those things.
Yeah, I mean, we actually typically don't have it suggest things. We want people to sort of, when they get to the point where they need the functionality that linking up will provide, then it happens.
Okay. Yeah.
But the point is very much, I mean, one thing that we've really tried for is to not have you going off to separate configuration modes or having to learn a configuration language, mm-hmm. but to be doing everything in the context of your data. Mm-hmm. And so in the UI, you would be looking at a record for an investment that was made in this data set, and it would say this investment was, you know, this firm was made in this state for this amount, and you would click on the field state that says California and say, you know what, this should no longer be text, this should be a link to a state object, and it will make that connection. It will either create a new state object for California, or if it's found one in this table that we already brought in, it'll link that up. And then that record for that investment will be linked for the record that you already have for California, and so you can drill from that down to say, okay, this investment of this amount was made in a state with this population, or, you know, whatever calculation that you want to do, whatever relationship that you want to establish between those things.
Right.
And this goes back to where the users are coming from. These are people who typically use spreadsheets for this sort of task. They don't use, you know, databases. And the 10 or 20% of spreadsheets that people actually tend to use are the very direct manipulation things. They have a grid, they put data in, they deal with the data basically directly. You know, they highlight a column and say they want it subtotaled, that kind of thing. But they don't typically get into the parts that actually require configuration. So we wanted to sort of keep them in that comfort place.
Mm-hmm.
They're right.
Now, I wasn't actually going to bring up the fact that the system is written in Smalltalk, because that will only be of interest to a vanishingly small percentage of people, and probably should only be. But, you know, it actually strikes me that there's an interesting connection here, which is that the style of software development in something like a Smalltalk development environment very much exhibits those same principles, right, of direct manipulation, of incremental development, of always having immediate feedback as to what the results of any change that you have made are. And so the notion that you've reflected those principles from the underlying Smalltalk engine up into this, I hate to use the word user experience, but I just did, is interesting, I think. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's a cultural thing. I mean, we built a database application, but we didn't come from a database culture. We didn't come from a culture where we're expecting everything to be written in SQL, everything to be the traditional relational database model. We were coming from a culture where it was very much, the development of Smalltalk programs is very much something that you do hands-on, do just-in-time, do always having an example of your data and the running code in front of you. And I think that works much better, I mean, even for programmers, but especially for end users, for building abstractions is not to be off somewhere building this lofty abstraction and you're not even thinking about what the actual data is going to be, what the actual usage is going to be. But and this gets to some of the kind of agile programming theories, right? You want to be in the moment. You want to have your data sitting there in front of you and then realize that something's wrong. Realize, oh, actually, I typed this in just as, you know, a comma-separated list of names, but really that needs to be a structured list of people. Let me change that. Or, oh, I just kind of jotted down this appointment is tomorrow at 2 p.m., but you know what? I want to see this appear on a calendar. I want it to know that that's mm-hmm. a date so that it can parse that. And so this kind of evolving over time of the structure while you're looking all the time at your actual data is really important.
Yeah, I think so too. Another aspect of this that is quite interesting to me is the notion of what it means to scale. Right. So scaling is one of those just incredibly abused and overloaded terms in our industry. In your case, the system that you've built is in a style that would seem frankly crazy to a lot of people, which is it's an in-memory database.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it makes perfect sense, and it makes perfect sense because when I think about scaling, I think about scaling out many small instances rather than scaling up, if you will, you know, one monolithic thing. And I think that we've, in general, in the industry, radically underappreciated the importance of this scale-out phenomenon. So
yeah, we realized that very early on, that, I mean, all of our users, again, they're coming from spreadsheets, and until recently, the limits for the amount of data they could actually have in a single spreadsheet were something like 65,000, right? So it was a very small number. And so the bigger thing is definitely to be able to scale out, to sort of have these sort of islands of data that can exist on any servers anywhere. Our own operations problems go away completely, right? Because, you know, no matter how many more users we get, we can always just add more of these little islands anywhere. There's very little interaction between them, except through web services and that sort of thing, which is easy as well. Right? Mm-hmm. So it's sort of an inherently scalable, scale-out kind of architecture.
Mm-hmm. There's a potential drawback to that, which is that as and when you get to the place where you'd like to be able to aggregate across all of those islands, right, and begin to explore the kind of network effects that could emerge, then that's an impediment, right?
It is, although I think it's much more interesting. I mean, first of all, in almost all cases, the people that are using the software are business users, and for them, the privacy of their data is obviously very important, and so having it in these individual islands is really a benefit to them. We don't have to jump through any hoops to put any barriers between people's data. That's just a natural outcome of the architecture that's so, and they would not be very excited by having aggregation of their data with other people's data that are using the service.
Mm-hmm.
What's more interesting to us, really, in terms of those kinds of network effects, is aggregation of people's private data, or combination of people's private data with public data that's out there available on the web.
Yeah.
No matter what architecture we have internally, that's always going to be done as an arm's length web service. I mean, that's, and so I can even imagine that kind of arm's length web service communication happening between two of our databases, but having one huge data set internally for us isn't gonna buy us anything there.
Right.
But that kind of combination is something that we're really excited about, that people can take their private data, like, oh, their contact list and a list of addresses, and combine that with data that's out there on the web, like the data that's available for the estimated price of a home. So suddenly you've got your list of sales leads, say, and you have an estimate of how much their home's worth, and that lets you do some very interesting market segmentation that you wouldn't have been able to do until you had done that combination. Or you've got a list of your competitors, and you can go do a lookup on the Google PageRank of each of their URLs, and suddenly you know who you need to be worrying about more than others. This kind of thing is again, I mean, getting back to enriching people's data is huge, and it's something that we really want to explore a lot.
So you mentioned the privacy issue, and that's obviously going to deter some people from ever using a system like this. Others obviously are undeterred. You have customers, and so they've concluded that it's, you know, a reasonable trade-off. How do you have that conversation with people about how they evaluate that trade-off?
Well, there's two sides to it, right? There's basically the old hosted debate. So do you have your data hosted on someone else's servers? And, I mean, the response that's typically given to that, and a lot of people do understand, is that a company that's provided a hosted service, it's very much in their interest to make sure things are secure, and it's probably much more secure than the data that's sitting on their laptop. So there's sort of a segment of the market that you can actually, you know, explain that to, and they'll get that. The other side of it is the idea of having all the data encrypted on our service.
The translucent option.
Exactly, and only unencrypted on the client side whenever they needed to. So they're having, you know, being a special key that would do that.
Yep.
And this would only occur for the most sensitive data.
Yep.
Because, you know, obviously it limits what we can offer for that data. We can't do searching and sorting on data that's encrypted.
Yes.
That sort of thing. But we've had some positive feedback on that idea from some of our customers.
I'm actually really interested in that. A friend of mine, Peter Wehner, wrote this book, Translucent Databases. Have you seen it?
No.
It's an excellent and very underappreciated book on the principle of least information, basically. And he explores a lot of scenarios in which you can have a system where, in fact, the operator of the database has no access to the data. It's actually quite interesting to sort of think through application scenarios from that perspective. And, in fact, I think the main takeaway from his book is that as an industry, our assumption has always been, of course, we're going to retain and store everything. And we never think in terms of the liability that's associated with that. And therefore, we never think in terms of, well, now, if I regard that as a liability and I want to avoid it where possible, you know, what protocols are possible? And it's actually a hard problem, but it's one that I don't really feel like people think about much. So I would be a huge supporter of seeing that kind of thing in your system. And then, because it's one of those things, again, where it needs to exist in an environment that's very fluid, where people can kind of explore what that would mean, right? Because you're not going to know up front, right? You're going to have to kind of work your way through.
Mm-hmm. We've been surprised by how many people are willing to, from what kinds of organizations are willing to go the hosted route, and especially talking to some with this kind of translucent database idea, with this kind of encrypted idea, that would be willing. I mean, we had a long conversation recently with someone from a branch of the U.S. government who was, you know, interested in using Babel to manage some very sensitive information, and I was expecting the whole time for them to say, this has to be an appliance, this has to be behind the firewall, there is no way we are letting this out, and that wasn't their attitude.
Right.
The attitude was, we've got to, you know, work together to make sure that the encryption is appropriate and that you know, be satisfied with the security, but that the hosted model, in terms of being able to deliver application updates quickly, in terms of us being responsible for making sure the system was actually up and running, was appealing to them.
Right.
If that kind of a situation is possible, then really almost anyone should ultimately be able to be comfortable with it. So I'm very positive about this, and we've absolutely resisted going the appliance route because we want to solve these problems in the hosted space.
Right.
We would rather put in the extra effort to make sure that the hosted system was satisfying these people rather than go down the appliance road.
Right.
Given the resources that we have, right? I mean, if we were a bigger organization, then it would be a different story.
Right. So related to this, then, is the question of availability. So somebody can say, well, you know, I mean, you're a couple of guys from Vancouver with this little company, right? I mean, you know, how effectively are you going to be able to maintain a high availability system? I suppose, from my perspective, the answer to that is that everything is trending the right way for you in terms of the kinds of Amazon infrastructures that are emerging and things like that, right? So it's, you know,
right.
In other words,
right.
You know, this is maybe for now a problem that you may be needing to solve for yourself, but in a year or so, 18 months, it just isn't going to be, right?
Well, and it's worth noting that in practice, we don't really find it to be a problem at all. It is highly available. I don't think we have much in terms of outages at all. And also, because things are segmented in the way that they are, typically if there is some sort of problem, it's affecting one user, not the whole swath of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we are a couple of guys in Vancouver, you know, a couple of more guys in the company, but this stuff is very easy to outsource, and we, in fact, don't own any servers,
right?
None of this stuff is running on, we have never seen the servers that this is running on, we have never seen the data center that this is running in, right? Because someone else is taking care of that.
Right.
And that's just the way things are going to go,
yeah.
Right? You have companies like Amazon that have huge infrastructure with huge operations teams, and they are keeping the basics running. And really, it becomes up to us to write the software and make sure the software is working. And
it's a great time to be doing services, software services, right?
Yeah.
It's like, because you can spend 100%, pretty much 100% of your time on the part that matters,
yeah.
Which is just a good deal. Well, what else do you want to just kind of pitch in here before we sign off? Anything that comes to mind?
I talked about sort of trying to make data richer, and the other thing that we're really excited about and kind of keep refining is the notion of evolving data over time. You never get it right the first time that you put it in,
mm-hmm.
Right? When you're entering data for the first time, you have a vague sense of what the structure of the data is going to be, of what kinds of things you need to capture. And as you work with this, you're going to learn a lot about what you need, and what's really important is to be able to make those changes. And you can't make those changes if you're using something pre-built for you, project management system that you've gone out and bought off the shelf. You can't usually make those changes if you've hired a consultant to build something for you internally, because it's going to be too expensive or too complicated to get them to come in and modify it. And often you can't realistically make those changes if you're using a traditional database system, something like Access, where it's very hard once you've got data in there to migrate it. And so we've been trying to give people a platform where they really can, if they're using a piece of software, if they're using a database, and they realize that something's not right about it, they can make that change themselves, have their data actually migrate properly without worrying about it, and move forward as they learn more about their needs. And that's so key.
That's a huge point. And so we should be clear, you guys are not the kind of database development, or database-backed application development environment that others are,
mm-hmm.
But so, for example, recently I've been doing a project with Django, which is the sort of the Rails for Python, if you will. And so, you know, in the beginning, it's just lovely because you write the model and you punch a button, it generates the SQL, and off and running. And then, you know, a couple days later, schema evolution. What about that, right? And
yeah.
Then, you know, it's like, oh,
yeah.
Right. And I think maybe Rails has a story for that somewhat, but I'm sure it's complicated. And
but those are developer stories, right?
Right. Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. And in fact, so with Django, there isn't really yet one. And so, you know, it's like back to, you know, SQL, you know, update and alter.
It's useful to note how far we've taken it, too. I mean, this is, again, coming out of that sort of small talk, extreme programming kind of culture. which is to actually, you know, take some of these concepts and make them solid in the system. For example, like real refactorings. So, for example, there's things like oftentimes you'll import data from a spreadsheet and it'll have something where you'll have a column where it's person 1, person 2, person 3, person 4 as separate columns. And so when you get them in your database, you'll see these as sort of separate fields.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's ugly refactoring, and what you kind of really want it to be is sort of a too-many. So you can there's a way to just say, well, I'll take all of these fields together and make them into a list of new people entries in the system, right? So it's very much taking that in basically selecting one action by a user and saying, I'd actually like this to be a list, and it just does all the work that's associated with that, including moving all the data around.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that's really powerful, and I think there's a lot further we can go with it.
Mm-hmm. For the developer types who may be listening, mm-hmm. when you start to go down that path, can you walk back from it? In other words, if you want to get back to a structured, a classically structured, you know, situation?
In terms of getting back to things, I mean, certainly we offer undo. So anything, we think it's really important that people be able to experiment with things like that. Experiment with saying, you know what, I want to do this restructuring, and then say, you know what, that was the wrong thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Let's back out. I'm not sure if that was what
you were
asking.
The question would be more like, if I want to relationalize
the
stuff, actually want to suck it out, you know, and, you know, in other words, I've walked down this path to a certain point, and now I actually feel like I have the basis of something that I would want to shift into conventional database back environment, right? So now I do actually have to relationalize all this stuff.
Right, so you can export the data in a bunch of CSVs that actually have IDs, so if you were to pull those into a relational database, it would work just fine, actually.
Cool. And we have customers that do that, right, that essentially use Dabble as a prototyping tool.
Yes.
Right? So it's so much easier for them to get the data and get their structure right using Dabble, using the refactorings that we have, and then once they think they've got it right, then they will spit it out to MySQL or Postgres database.
Yep. That's a huge thing. I actually want to stress that because the point here is that from my perspective, you learn about what things need to be as people use those things that you are building.
Right.
So what you want is an environment where from the get-go, people are putting in real data, and they are really using that data, and they are themselves expressing from their perspective what the evolution of that data needs to be. And, you know, this is an environment in which you can capture those intentions, over time, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and so, yeah, I think that's huge.
I think the most gratifying thing, too, with that is that we've had people who've planned to do that, planned to prototype, and then put it back into their database.
They ship the prototype.
And then exactly decided that, well, no, this is perfect. Actually, I want to be able to change it later.
Well, exactly, because, you know, once you've exported it, once you've locked it down, then you're back to the same old problems of, oh, now, you know, there's one more change I need to make. Now what do I do, right?
Yeah.
And so it gets appealing just to leave it in Dabble, which is great.
Okay. Well, excellent. Thanks, guys. This was this was on.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.